Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program that looks at the economic dimensions of our lives, our incomes, our jobs, our debts, the prospects for this economy, literally everything that has to do with putting food on the table, organizing the economics of our lives. My name is Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities. Currently, I teach in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. I wanted to also invite you, if you're interested in the kinds of analysis we present on this program, to take a look at the two websites that we maintain and that we update regularly. One is called rdwolff.com, and the other one is democracyatwork.info. There you will see both the kinds of analysis of our economic situation that we stress, but also at the democracyatwork.info website, the kinds of solutions we believe offer the best hope for our future. Also, both websites provide you a way to communicate to us, to send us your comments, your criticisms, your questions. We read each and every one. We use them to design the program, but also we select one or two questions to respond to on every program. So if you're interested in communicating to us, please go again to either of the two websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info, to let us know what you think. In the last week, a number of things arose that I think deserve our attention. This week, there will begin to be confirmation hearings in the United States Senate for the proposed new director of the Federal Reserve System. Given the role of the United States in the world economy, the role of the dollar in the world economy, the person who heads up the Federal Reserve System, effectively the central bank of the United States, has quite a bit of power to shape world economic events. Ben Bernanke, the current chair, is coming to the end of his term and has to be succeeded, and President Barack Obama has nominated Janet Yellen. So I wanted to talk a little bit about Janet Yellen, the issues she faces, what she represents, and I have an opportunity to do that. It's a little bit unusual because Janet Yellen and I had the exact same graduate training in economics, leading to the same degree, PhD in economics, from the same university, Yale University, very close together. I got my degree in 1969 from that university, and she got hers in 1971. We had the same curriculum and the same professors. Indeed, the professor who taught her and me the macroeconomics that is the most key basis for what you do as head of the Federal Reserve was the same professor, James Tobin, who later won a Nobel Prize. And so I know pretty well what's in her mind and how she was trained, since it is the same for me, even though our trajectories since graduate school, since earning our PhDs, have been notably different. The training we got reflected the dominant school of economics at the time, in the 1960s and 70s. That school had the name Keynesianism because its leading inspirer, its leading theoretician, was John Maynard Keynes, a leading economist in Great Britain who became famous during the Great Depression for questioning the orthodoxy of his time and basically proposing that capitalism, if left to its own devices, produces extraordinary inequality and extraordinary instability, such as the Great Depression, in the middle of which he wrote his famous work. So Keynes's argument was, if you want the benefits of capitalism, and he was a great admirer of capitalism, then you have to have the government intervene systematically to put away the negative consequences of capitalism and to ensure that positive outcomes happen, because a capitalism left to itself, private enterprises left to do what they want in their own interest, produces economic disaster. That was Keynes's argument, and he developed the monetary and fiscal policy ideas that have been followed ever since. So Janet Yellen, the person being confirmed, is a person who was trained in the notion that the government can, the government should, and indeed the government must intervene systematically. This is a bit complicated because shortly after the 1970s, with the arrival of Margaret Thatcher in power in England and Ronald Reagan in the United States, the conventional wisdom of economics changed drastically. The conservative right wing emerged with the idea that it was best for the government to be minimized, for the government to deregulate, for the government to get out of the business of economic intervention, with the theory that a capitalist system left to itself without government intervention would work best. Mrs. Yellen accommodated this idea, as most economists did, some with greater enthusiasm, some with less. So one would have to define Janet Yellen as occupying a place somewhere between the Keynesian interventionist economics she learned as a graduate student, as I did, and the more right-wing skepticism about the government that has been the dominant ideology for most of the time since both Yellen and I graduated. So what would I expect from Janet Yellen, and what can we expect? On the one hand, she is not going to upset the apple cart. She's been a loyal assistant to Ben Bernanke for many years. She obviously accepts not only the wisdom of capitalism, but basically the wisdom of keeping the government from too active a role in it. On the other hand, she will be loyal to Barack Obama, who nominated her, and she will continue to advocate that the Federal Reserve intervene with monetary policy, pumping up the money supply, keeping interest rates close to zero, in the hopes that private enterprise borrows money, that individuals borrow money and stimulate the economy that way. In short, Janet Yellen represents no big change, no big alteration, maybe a slight tilting to her education in Keynesian economics, but no kind of basic shift in policy. And in my judgment, that's a disaster, because if there's anything this economy needs, it's a basic shift in policy. Why? We are now in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. It is now in its sixth year. It begins officially in December of 2007, and we're near to December of 2013. That's 6 years. The policies followed by the government have not worked. We are not even halfway back to the level of unemployment we had before this crisis hit, and that involved millions of people whose jobs were not available and whose skills and energy were being wasted by an economic system that doesn't know how to put together unemployed people and unutilized resources to produce the wealth we need. In any case, by being a person from whom no sharp change will come, we can expect no change in the basic policy, and as it hasn't worked for the last 6 years, I'm not holding my breath for any kind of economic breakthrough anytime soon. Indeed, I noticed that last week at a conference of the International Monetary Fund in Washington, the person who was scheduled to be the next head of the Federal Reserve, Lawrence Summers, who was put aside, who withdrew his name, was uncharacteristically honest. Perhaps if you're no longer in the running, you can tell it like it is. And he said, there is no recovery, and there is no recovery in sight, and the conventional policy isn't working. He probably wouldn't have said that if he were in Miss Yellen's shoes, but now that he isn't, he does, and it gives me a chance to quote a person I normally wouldn't in support of the notion that Miss Yellen represents no change at a time when what we need is real change more than ever. My next update has to do with the minimum wage here in the United States, and I wanted to bring to your attention some basic facts. In his State of the Union message earlier this year, President Obama said that he believed the minimum wage should be raised from the current $7.25 an hour, yes, that's what it is, an hour, to $9. And then last week, he raised his idea it should go to $10. It's interesting that he has the courage to even propose that, and it's clear why. There has been a mass movement in the United States for the last 6 or more months on the part of Walmart workers, McDonald's, hamburger workers, and others demanding that poverty level wage, which is what $7.25 an hour means, is an outrageous insult to the people of the United States and sheds very poor light on the quality of this economy in terms of what it offers people for hours of their labor. And the polls in America show, Gallup poll and other poll, that an overwhelming majority of Americans, more than three quarters of our people, support raising the minimum wage. So it's wildly popular, and there's a real movement. That's the kind of thing that gets politicians, sometimes, to pay attention. And Barack Obama did and is pushing for a higher wage. It's interesting also that in the elections earlier this month, in the state of New Jersey, for example, the people voted for the popular governor there, Chris Christie, and yet he's the same governor who vetoed an increase in the minimum wage proposed for the state of New Jersey last year, and who campaigned as part of his election effort against a ballot initiative to raise the minimum wage this year. The people of New Jersey elected Chris Christie again, but they also voted over 60% in favor of raising the minimum wage in that state and against Mr. Christie on that point. So, do we then have a minimum wage rise in this country? Frankly, I doubt it, given the control of the Republicans. But I want to put it in perspective. Even if we did raise the minimum wage, and even if it went all the way to $10, in terms of purchasing power, a $10 minimum wage today is worth less than the minimum wage was worth back in 1968. That's right. In 1968, the minimum wage adjusted for the prices people had to pay meant that a person earning the minimum wage was able to buy more goods and services in 1968 than even $10 would allow him or her to purchase today. In real terms, the minimum wage is lower at $7.25, far lower than it was 40 years ago, a stunning comment, since people at the minimum wage are working harder, are working more productively with more and better machines than ever before, and yet they're actually paid less. Final point on the minimum wage. It's $7.25 an hour in the United States. I'm now going to list a group of countries, advanced industrial countries like the United States, to give you an idea of what the minimum wage is in many other countries in the world that are not as wealthy, not as powerful, and not as quote-unquote capitalist as we are. And here's what they do for their workers at the bottom. Remember, the American wage today, $7.25, as it was in 2011 when these statistics were created and collected. So I'm going to read to you what other countries did who did better than the United States. Japan, $9.16 compared to the American $7.25. Canada, $9.76. New Zealand, $10.22. Netherlands, $11.38. Belgium, $11.92. Ireland, $12.03. France, $12.55. Luxembourg, $14.21. And the number one winner, Australia, at $15.75. These are all economies, some of whom are doing better, some of whom doing not as well as the United States. Bottom line, you can pay much more in the minimum wage, do right by the poorest in your society, and do perfectly well. The argument in the United States that this is impossible and can't be done is counteracted and contradicted by what other societies have been doing and are doing very well. Okay, my next update has to do with a famous company, Twitter. And Twitter just announced that it is moving into a major new building in an underdeveloped part a downcast part of San Francisco. It got an enormous tax advantage from the city of San Francisco, estimated by the Reuters News Service to be a tax break worth $22 million for renovating that building and moving its headquarters in there. And there's been a to-do in San Francisco, understandably, because the $22 million that the city of San Francisco won't get and has to give to Twitter will come out of other programs that city needs to provide to its people, or will require them to raise taxes on others. And it's not clear that a billion-dollar company that went public in enormous fanfare last week needs or deserves that kind of tax support. It drove home also to many people in San Francisco the fact that the minute Twitter moves into that area, all the rents in that neighborhood will go up. That will force all the least capable economically of the citizens of that area to flee, to crowd into other less expensive neighborhoods. It's that peculiar urban renewal that seems to favor those with the most money, with tax gimmicks and tax giveaways, and hurt most those least able to take it. But that's not really the point I want to make. That point is being made in public demonstrations by angry residents of this neighborhood in San Francisco and by a lively debate there over the pros and cons of tax giveaways to big business. What I want to stress is that Twitter, like so many quote-unquote private enterprise techno leaders, is in fact being helped once again by the government. The federal government helped support the universities and the military establishment that invented the internet. The federal government, that is your money and my money and taxes, has been a key partner to all of these companies at our expense throughout their history. San Francisco is just doing it again. Question: if society funds so much of what these high-tech companies do, then why isn't society a part owner of these enterprises, able to cash in on the success they achieve, the money they earn, since that would not have been possible without systematic subsidies by the public along the way? It's hard not to come to the conclusion that our private enterprise capitalist system is a system in which private enterprises capture the rewards, even though the public, through the government, carries much of the cost of the investment, carries much of the cost of building up these companies. In Europe, you know, when the government helps corporations, it often takes a position, becomes a part owner, and therefore cashes in on some of the benefits. It's always struck me as bizarre that in the United States we don't do that. And when we celebrate how private successful they are, let's remember the role that our taxes play in it. October was also the release of the statistics, early November was the release of the statistics for October, and I wanted to bring one to your attention for those of you that still believe when you read in the newspaper how we have a recovery. Here's the statistic that was released early this month, covering the whole year, the fiscal year of October, from each year to year October 12 to October 13, October 11 to October 2012, and so on. Median real weekly in earnings. That's the number I want you to pay attention to. Here's what it means. It's the number that tells us 50% of Americans earned more than that, and 50% earned less. So it's a good measure of how people in general have been doing. Okay, 2009 was the highest. 2009, because the full effect of the economic crisis hadn't set in. So median real weekly earnings, $345. Wow. From Bureau of Labor Statistics. Ever since then, it has been going down. It went from 345 to 342 in 2010, then down to 336 in 2011, and then down to 333 in 2012 and 13. No recovery whatsoever, decline or a plateau. We haven't even begun to turn up from the high point in 2009. Those are not statistics about a recovery. Those are statistics about continued decline. My last short update before we turn to a more major discussion has to do with the United States' claimed commitment to having the government get out of the economy, the kind of argument that I spoke about in the years since Janet Yellen and I graduated from Yale. The government of the United States supposedly committed to free trade, to having the government get out of interference in trade, and so on. You will then be surprised, perhaps, or maybe not, to see, as I did, what the vote was last week about a possibility of getting away from controlled and government interference in trade to something closer to free trade. In the United Nations, a proposal was put forward, and the proposal called on the United States to end the blockade, that the United States has imposed on trade with Cuba for over half a century. That's right. For half a century, the United States government has intervened by forbidding, rendering illegal, trade between the United States and Cuba. So last week, there was a vote in the United States. All 193 countries that are members of the United States voted on this question: should the United States end the embargo? Out of 193 nations, 188 voted in favor of ending the embargo. Only two countries favored continuing the embargo: the United States and Israel. Three countries abstained. They are tiny islands in the Pacific with virtually no population. So it is clear what the world thinks. Every single country in Latin America voted in favor of ending that embargo. It's an interesting comment on the United States' commitment to free trade. And the arguments given: that Cuba does not permit a free press. Cuba, therefore, is one of many, many countries that might fall under that. That Cuba hasn't got a wonderful record on civil liberties. Very few countries do. And that Cuba should be more like other Latin American countries in its economic policies. Interestingly, that's the view of the United States that voted to keep the embargo, but not the view of any other Latin American country that voted unanimously, all of them, to end the embargo. Let me turn then to some substantive issues that deserve our attention. This last week, a sad event occurred that needs some comment. It was the decision of the Fagor Company, F-A-G-O-R, a producer of home appliances that is part of the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation in Spain. It announced bankruptcy. It announced it would have to go out of business. Why? Well, the answer for that is very simple. Spain is in the grip, as is all of Europe, of an enormous economic crisis, which right now is worse there than even it is here in the United States, let alone other parts of the world. One of the things hit hardest in Europe is the housing industry. And as a result, the demand for refrigerators, for washing machines, the very things that this Fagor Corporation makes, has plunged. And like many other corporations, it cannot find a market for the products it produces. But it drew some attention because it's part of a cooperative corporation, the Mondragon, the most successful worker co-op probably in the world, encompassing over 100,000 workers, seventh or eighth largest corporation in all of Spain. Turns out it is vulnerable to the same breakdown of global capitalism that has rendered so many other businesses vulnerable, so many people out of work. Some, like the British journal The Economist, have spoken as though, aha, now worker co-ops have to face hard economic realities. And here we have to take exception. The economic reality that is causing trouble in this co-op has nothing to do with the co-op. It has to do with the fact that this co-op exists in an economy that isn't organized cooperatively. This co-op exists, like co-ops everywhere in the world, in an economy dominated by a completely different economic system, namely capitalism. it isn't the co-ops that failed in Spain. It's the capitalist banks and the capitalist housing industry of Spain that collapsed. It isn't the co-ops that failed to produce quality goods. No one in their right mind is claiming that. It isn't the co-op that has failed to maintain its standards. No one is claiming that. What has happened to the co-op is that the larger economy, a capitalist economy in which it functions, has broken down. And the reverberations of that capitalist breakdown are not limited to capitalist enterprises. In other words, it's a little bit like saying that the mass unemployment in the world has something to do with these workers rather than with a system that was able to employ them up until 2007 and has now failed to employ them for the last 6 years. There's nothing wrong with the quality of their work. There's nothing wrong with the quality of the output they produce. It's a system that doesn't work, that fails to provide them the jobs that they were promised, that they went to school for, that they're eager to fill, and whose products we need, but a system that can't put these things together. The workers are victims of capitalism, and so are the cooperative enterprises. And indeed, nothing shows the importance of worker co-ops better than how they are reacting to the failure of the larger capitalist market to absorb the goods that the Fagor workers, 2,000 and so of them, have been producing for many years very successfully. The proof of the value of worker co-op is that the Mondragon Corporation is committed to maintaining the jobs and or the livelihoods of all 2,000 workers because they're members of that co-op. Because the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation is actually a family of about 300 co-ops, unified by a planning system, let me say that again, a planning system that moves workers from where there are job opportunities among these co-ops to places where the job opportunities are greater. They move the workers from where jobs are shrinking, like at Fagor, to places where jobs are growing. And they maintain the workers, even if it takes some time to make that transition, because we are in a broad economic crisis. Here is an entity that is working, a planning unit, overlooking all of these co-ops in order to maximize the well-being of workers even through a hard time. By contrast, in capitalist societies, an employer who goes out of business simply fires the workers. They're on their own. Fend for yourself. Find a job if you can. Nobody will help you. Maybe you can go to the state, but these days the state is being hampered by the same capitalist crisis, so it's doing less for workers than it ever did before. None of that oppresses the workers at Mondragon because they have an institution that not only gives them democracy on the job, but also plans and coordinates to help one group of workers live even in hard times by sharing the effort across the whole family of workers. So it's actually a better mechanism to cope with the kinds of problems capitalism imposes even on worker co-ops. Imagine with me then what we could have if we had a planned economic system that tried to do for everybody what the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation is trying to do for the 300 member co-ops within it. Suppose we had a society that tried to help all of the people laid off when there's an economic crisis. Wow, you might even have a planning society which said, we're not going to allow crisis in the first place. Since we can understand the fundamental irrationality in any economy of having millions of workers who want to work, having all the tools and equipment and raw materials sitting idle, as we do in the world today, that those workers could work with, having an economic system that can't put them together, if we had a cooperative planning system, of course we'd put them together. We wouldn't be worrying about private profit because private profit is less important than avoiding the colossal suffering and waste of having unemployed people alongside unutilized resources failing to produce the output that could solve our social problems. We're now halfway through our program. I want to ask you all, please, to stay with us. We're going to have our short break. This is Richard Wolff at Economic Update, and we'll be back in a matter of seconds. Welcome back, friends. This is Economic Update. My name is Richard Wolff. I'm your host. And in this second half of our weekly program, I want to once again open by inviting you to send your questions and comments and criticisms to either of our two websites, rdwolff.com or democracyatwork.info. Which both have both materials for you and ways for you to communicate directly with us. This part of the program is, as always, devoted to discussions of major topics. And one that I am interested in presenting to you today responds to many of your questions. And it has to do with the distinction between quote-unquote public universities and quote-unquote private universities. In the United States, as in most countries, the overwhelming bulk of education, primary, secondary, and higher education, college and university level, is a function of the government, of the state. There are many reasons for that. In some countries, it is considered to be undemocratic to have both public universities available to everybody and private universities that can be restrictive in who they allow in, either by using criteria of grades on exams or charging money or a variety of other mechanisms. So in some societies, having a private university alongside a public university is ruled out, on grounds of democracy. In other societies, it is ruled out because it is thought that somehow it shouldn't be closed to anyone to have the best education possible, and that even if a private university could be better, it is not fair to exclude people on grounds of capacity to pay. And in other societies, it's simply history. And the idea is that education, like access to the beach, like access to public parks, is something that should be given to everyone as a fundamental human right, and that therefore the government should provide it, and it should be at no cost, which it widely is. In the United States, however, we have a sizable private university sector, and I want to talk about the economics of that so that everyone understands. In a public university, all that we mean is that the government runs the university, and typically that the government subsidizes a large part of the cost of providing the laboratories, the classrooms, the dormitories, and all the rest. Typically, in the United States for sure, public universities do not pay the entire cost. Part of that cost is paid for by students who pay tuition, room and board fees, and so on. And over recent decades, as the state has withdrawn the amount of support it gives to public universities, more and more has been demanded of the individual working class and middle class and upper class families that send their young people to these schools in the way of private tuition payments. So while they are still public universities, they are partly funded by private individuals. I turn now to the thing I'm most interested in, the so-called private university. I attended three of those here in the United States, Harvard, Stanford, and Yale, and so I know quite intimately how they work, and I have used my economics education to examine their economic conditions. And the thing I want to stress to you is what surprised me when I studied, especially Yale University, where I was a graduate student and got my PhD in economics. What surprised me was that this private university isn't in fact private at all. And indeed, if I had a title for this section of our program today, it would sound like something like this: The Scandal of the So-Called Private University. Why? Well, for most of the last 30, 40 years, where I have looked at the books of Yale University, here's what I discovered: that the largest single source of revenue for that university, Yale, and there's no reason to question whether the same isn't true of Stanford or Harvard or Princeton or any of the other private universities, the largest single source of income for Yale was the federal government of the United States, using tax money, money paid by all the citizens of the United States that flows to Washington, and that in Washington is turned around and given to Yale University. Let me be real clear here. The money from Washington is more in its total than all the tuition, room and board payments paid by Yale students, undergraduate and graduate combined. What does the government give money to Yale for? Here's typically how it works. A professor or a group of professors at Yale, I myself participated in this, submits to a government agency, the Defense Department, the Office of Homeland Security, the Office of Health, Education, and Welfare, and so on, whatever the department. A group of professors submit a proposal to do some research. And let's say when you put together the cost of the university professor's salary and some graduate student assistance and so on, it comes to, say, $300,000. The actual grant submission to Washington isn't for $300,000. It's for $300,000 plus, and here comes the good part, a university markup, which in the case of Yale is usually in the neighborhood of 60 to 70%. That is another 60 to 70% above the actual cost of the research is added. And this is money given to Yale to help defray the costs of the Yale equipment and the Yale buildings. And the, in other words, it's money to run Yale University. So the government pays not only the cost of the research, which often includes parts of the professor's salary, and grants to students that the university might otherwise have to pay. It doesn't just include that. It's an additional 60 to 70% cash gift to the university. So who pays for Yale? The people of the United States contribute the biggest single source. But there's more. One of the second or third largest incomes to the private university are gifts from corporations, gifts from wealthy alumni. How does that work? Well, here again, notice the corporation gives a gift, say $1 million, or a wealthy individual gives a gift, say $1 million. The person gives the gift of $1 million, but it doesn't cost that person or that corporation $1 million. Why not? Because under the law of the United States, that person can deduct that gift from their taxable income, reducing what they have to pay to Uncle Sam by between 30 and 50% of the gift. In other words, when the individual gives Yale $1 million, we, the taxpayer, have to come up with the extra money that that rich person doesn't have to pay in taxes, because that rich person saves $300,000 to $500,000 on his or her taxes, same for a corporation, if they give a gift to Yale. The money they don't pay to Uncle Sam, we either suffer fewer government programs or we have to make it up in extra taxes for what these wealthy people can avoid in taxes when they give a gift to a private university. Notice, the private university is getting the benefit of gifts that are larger for them than the donor has to pay, because we all give a tax break to the donor. Wow. Tax money coming to Yale directly for those grants for research, and now tax money being used as an incentive for private people to give money to Yale. Without the federal government, without the public purse pouring billions of dollars into private universities, they couldn't exist. They would be much smaller and much less important institutions. They get, in short, public government welfare. And it's an irony that we permit in our society, as I tried to say with my example of Twitter in the first half, that we permit private institutions to make private decisions favoring their private donors and their private students, usually from the wealthiest parts of our society, using government money that we all must pay. Why isn't the public, which pays for these universities, playing a major role in deciding what happens there? That would be the minimal democratic demand. And we really should stop calling them private universities, because when it comes to the money that sustains them, they are as dependent on the public purse as anyone getting welfare in this society ever was. Let me turn now to a couple of questions that you have sent to me, because we are coming toward the end of our program when we do that sort of thing. And here's the first question that was sent in by one of you and that I want to talk a little bit about. It has to do with the idea that came up in this program as it has in others. Suppose we had a rationally organized economic system, in other words, a non-capitalist system, and one that said it is absurd to have 20 million people either unemployed or underemployed, and that's the number we have today. It is absurd to have that at the same time that we have 20%, that's the statistic from the Federal Reserve, 20% of our tools, equipment, machines, factory, store, and office floor space sitting empty, idle, gathering dust or rust, being wasted. We have the people who want to work. We have the tools and equipment and raw materials they need to work with. 20 million people working with 20% of our industrial capacity could produce in the neighborhood of $2 trillion worth of output. That would be a way of dealing with world poverty, be a way of overcoming the destruction and decay of our central big cities, and on and on. We could really do things in our society if we used the tools, equipment, and raw materials that we're wasting, and gave jobs to people who ask nothing more than to be given a job, to use their skills. But this capitalist system can't put these things together. Claims to be efficient, but look at it. So here's the question that comes from an attentive listener. Wouldn't there be a problem, he says, if we got those people together, put them to work, we had a rational economic system of everybody working who wants to, using the raw materials and equipment we want to, adding the question, we would only have people work if we wanted to have that much output. If we were more concerned, for example, to save the resources of our planet, to make do with less, because it would give us leisure, because it would be less damaging for the environment, then we would have a rational debate in our society, a democratic decision, and maybe everybody would go from a 40-hour week to a 30-hour week. Yes, we'd have more, less output, and we would have to decide whether that's more worthwhile, even if we do without, because we would be saving our environment and we would be gaining leisure. A rational society would make that debate happen and then make that decision democratically. We don't do either of those things, and that's one of the costs of a capitalist system. But the question is different that has come in. It touches all those points, but it asks this question. Suppose we did all that and we put everybody to work because that's what we wanted. The 20 million got a job. The 20% of tools and equipment made use of. The output being generated. Wouldn't there then be an inflation? Wouldn't we then have that problem? And what do I have to say about that, since I advocate both a democratic workplace and a rational reorganization of our economy, not only to democratize the workplace, but to make use of all the people who want to work and to make a democratic decision about how much work and output we want and how much leisure and conservation of our planet we want. Work that out the way reasonable people can and should do. Well, here's my answer. We don't have to worry about inflation. Inflation is a problem peculiar, particularly, to capitalism. And indeed, the most staggering inflations on record, like, for example, the one in Germany in the 1920s, the one in China at the end of World War II, these were in economies that were capitalistically organized. And here is what that kind of inflation looks like and why it happens. When you have something like full employment, that is, which is very unusual in capitalism. Capitalism has only very rarely been able to get even close to full employment. One of its major flaws is that it is always showing big signs of unemployment, more or less, but very rarely full employment. But when it gets close, the following temptation occurs. Producers, capitalists, knowing that not much more can be produced because we're at full employment, either there aren't many more workers available to do work, or there aren't many more inputs available, we're using all the machines, we're using all the raw materials. When you're at that kind of point, it becomes tempting to a capitalist to jack up the prices, because he knows that he's not in danger, if he raises the price, of other people coming in and producing a lot of this stuff without raising the price, causing him to lose business, because that's what can't be done. We're at the full employment level. And of course, if a capitalist does that, then workers and others who want to buy goods suddenly discover the prices are going up. And when the prices go up, workers want their wages to go up so they can afford to pay the higher prices. They want to play catch-up. So the workers push for higher wages. And if they're successful, the capitalists say, oh my goodness, I have to pay higher wages. Now I'm going to try to raise my prices so I recoup the extra money I have to pay my workers in higher wages. This is then called a wage-price spiral. In other words, wherever it starts, between the capitalist's incentive to make more money by raising prices and the worker's incentive to keep pace with rising prices by raising their wages, you've got the ingredients for a cycle that builds on itself, and you can get an inflation like that. It has sometimes happened. But we are not powerless in the face of that. And let me give you an example of how it can be handled. One way is in fact the way that was handled by the Germans over the last 20, 30 years. When the Europeans got together and ended their individual currencies, the German mark in Germany, the French franc, the Italian lira, and so on, and they got together in what we now call the Eurozone, and all these countries agreed to use the euro as the new common currency instead of their old one, every country had to reprice everything they produced. A tomato in a market in Italy no longer cost so many lira, it now had to be repriced in euros. Your gas bill in Germany wasn't so many Deutschmark, it was in euros. Your glass of wine at a bar in France wasn't in francs, it was in euros. In this transition of everything having to be repriced in Europe, in euros, many, many businesses saw an opportunity too tempting to miss. And so basically, they changed from their own currency to a euro, but at the same time, they jacked up the price. so that the euro price of a tomato in Italy was actually higher than the old lira price had been, and the glass of wine in France in euros cost more than the equivalent in the old French francs. In other words, inflation set in. The Germans understood this, and they were similarly tempted, but they understood the following possibility. If everywhere else in Europe, prices were rising because the euro gave an opportunity that capitalists and businesses everywhere simply thought a temptation they could not resist, then the Germans understood they could make a very good killing if they were able not to do that. Why? Because if prices rose in Italy, in Spain, in France, in Belgium, and so on, but they didn't rise in Germany, then buyers, consumers in Spain and Greece and Italy and France would discover that German goods weren't rising in price, whereas everybody else's were. If the Germans could prevent rising prices in their country, they could literally bring all the rest of Europe to buy German goods instead of goods made in their own country because the goods in their own country were rising in price. And that's what the Germans did. They did it through an agreement reached by their business and their labor unions, who got together, there's a long history of this kind of thing in Germany, who got together and agreed the companies would provide work and jobs if the workers would forego wage increases. And the businesses wouldn't raise German prices, which is what mostly German workers pay. So the workers would get job security, falling unemployment, and therefore guaranteed incomes, and they wouldn't lose from rising prices in Germany. And the Germans would instead keep their prices flat and get more and more business as buyers around Europe would switch to German prices, which were not rising the way their own were. It worked. Germany has done the best in this crisis. Germany's unemployment is among the lowest in Europe. Germany has weathered this crisis and come out stronger because it managed this inflation. So even in a capitalist economy, with more and more approach to full employment, not quite, but getting there, they've managed to avoid it to their own advantage. The second example of how you can avoid an inflation comes, you might be surprised to know, from the Republican Party in the United States and one of its more conservative presidents, Richard Nixon. Yep, Richard Nixon. Back in 1971, when the United States was indeed experiencing an inflation, the government decided something had to be done, and it did it, and it worked beautifully. Richard Nixon, on August 15th, 1971, goes on the television and he says to the American people, we have an inflation, and I'm going to do something about it. And he declared a wage price freeze. He said that nobody can raise their wages and nobody can raise their prices. And we're going to do this for at least 6 months to bring this inflation to a halt. It's going to be a law. If you're a businessman or woman and you raise a price, we're going to arrest you and put you in jail. If you're a trade union or any other worker association and you push and achieve a higher wage, the same is going to happen. It's going to become illegal because we want to be able to have people working full time if we can. We want production. We don't want to waste resources, but we do not want to suffer an inflation. And having the government come in and prevent one is a way to do it. It worked perfectly nicely. It brought the inflation down in a dramatic way. Other countries have used this kind of thing. It's sometimes called an incomes policy. Once again, showing that if a society has a commitment to solve economic problems, it can do so in a rational, orderly way. The solutions they find will generate new problems. That's always true. And we can live with that. The notion, however, that we can't have full employment because for some reason we'll have an inflation is usually an argument given by people who don't want the government to intervene to solve economic problems, who rather have that unemployment than risk the possibility of an inflation. We know that with the massive unemployment we have today, and the staggering losses it inflicts, and the staggering pain on countless millions of families, we know what a disaster that is, a disaster that has ramifications for decades into the future. To not solve that problem is inexcusable. To not solve that problem because it might create another problem down the road makes little sense. First, that problem may not develop. Second, even if it does, we have many historical examples of a variety of ways that we can solve the problem of inflation. It is not an acceptable excuse for failing to deal with the unemployment that has dogged and crippled the European economies, the United States economy, and many around the world now for years. A capitalism that can do no better than worry about a potential problem in the future as the excuse for not dealing with the real problem now is a capitalism that shows yet again its incapacity to serve the needs of people in today's real world. Thank you so much for your attention. This is Economic Update. I look forward to talking with you again next week. And do please remember to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Thank you. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.